Hello, and welcome to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales. Today we'll be listening to a story from the Armenian tradition called The Poor Widow's Son. As always, first we'll have the story, then a discussion about some elements of the story, and finally the recipe and how it links to the story itself. Shall we begin? Once upon a time, there was a king who had three daughters. This king liked to disguise himself and walk through the town, listening to what the people had to say about him and the conditions under which they lived. The three princesses slept in one room, and on this particular night they had their window open, their lamp burning, and they were talking. The king, seeing the light, drew near and decided to listen to what they were saying. "If my father gives me to a prince, I would make such a rug that all my father's soldiers could sit on it, and half of it would still be unused," said the first princess. "If my father gives me to a merchant, I would bake such a loaf of bread that all my father's soldiers could eat it, and half of it would still be unused," the second princess said. "The one who builds or pulls down the house is the wife," said the third princess. "I don't care who my father gives me to."
"What? How can that daughter of mine speak in such a way?" said the king. "I'll teach her something. I'll give her to a very poor man, and see if it's really the woman who's the builder of the house." So he called a poor widow's son, and gave the third princess to him. "Take her home with you. She's now your wife."
The lad took the princess to the house of his mother, a poor, broken-down hut near the bridge outside of the city. The widow, seeing the princess, said to her son, "We haven't got bread enough to keep us alive. You've brought home a princess. How shall we live now?"
"Don't be angry, Mama," said the princess.
"I've got some ideas." The next day, the lad went off to work and returned home with his earnings. The princess noticed that if her husband earned 50 coins, he spent all 50 that day, not saving a single coin, so she took it upon herself to correct him. "Husband, if you make 20 coins, let's save 10 and spend 10. Let's do that for a whole week and we'll see what happens." So each day of that week they saved some money, and at the end of the week she gave her husband these instructions. "Go to the marketplace and bring one spool of this thread and one spool of that thread and a list of other instructions." The lad went to the marketplace and bought the thread that his wife had asked for. She drew some beautiful original designs and began to embroider. As she was a princess and she did unusual needlework, her embroidery was very beautiful. She made 10 small pieces and gave them to her husband to sell for 1/2 gold piece each. Her husband sold the embroidery very quickly and with the money was ready to return home. They lived like this for a few months, but then they decided that the young man should travel and go to other countries in order to earn some money. On the following day, they saw a merchant crossing the bridge with 80 camel loads of merchandise destined for Arabia. The lad offered the merchant his services for the caravan. The merchant accepted and the lad came home to make ready. "Before you set out," said the young bride, "please visit the monastery where there's a very wise monk and ask him to give you some good advice, which you might need in your travels." The young husband visited the monk at his wife's request and was given these three pieces of advice. Firstly, that she, who the one loves the best, is the most beautiful. Secondly, patience leads to safety. And thirdly, there is good in every instance of waiting patiently. He came back to his wife, who said, "Commit those words to memory. You'll no doubt have need of them." The husband departed the next morning. After a long journey, the caravan camped in a desert near Arabia. There had camped before them also a large caravan composed of 80 other merchants. The widow's son was tired and soon fell into a deep sleep. There were so many men and animals in the caravan, and all of them were thirsty. It so comes to pass that in that desert there was only one well, and that was dangerous. All who had gone down to draw water had never returned. In the middle of the night, The lad was awakened by the crying of a herald in the caravan, who announced that each merchant was offering 10 pieces of gold to the man who would descend into the well and draw water for men and animals. The lad, who desperately needed the money, promised to go down. His master pitied him and tried to prevent him, but he couldn't dissuade him. The lad was here to seek his fortune, after all. "You're going to go down that dangerous well of your own free will," he said, "and your blood's going to be on your own head. But if you come out safely, one of my camels will be yours, with the merchandise upon it." They let the young man down with a rope. Reaching the bottom, he saw a flowing river of fresh water. He couldn't resist it. He drank and quenched his thirst. After that, showing a little bit more caution, he looked up. Nearby saw a giant sitting with a maiden on each side. One with golden hair, and another with silver hair. "Look, human being," explained the giant, "I'll ask you one question. If you answer it rightly, I'll let you go. If not, I will beat you to death with this club, as I have killed so many men before you. Which of these two maidens is the beautiful one? And which the ugly?" The widow's son remembered the first piece of advice he got from the old monk and said, "The person who one loves the most is the most beautiful." The giant jumped up and kissed the lad on the forehead. "Well done, lad. You gave me the only right answer. All the rest were wrong." He then asked the lad why he'd made a dangerous descent in the first place. He seemed impressed by his bravery and said, "This well is enchanted. I must therefore give you a safe conduct. Take these 3 apples, and after drawing water enough, when you go up, drop one of these apples as soon as your feet are lifted from the ground, drop the second one when you reach the middle, and the 3rd apple when you approach the well's mouth. Thus, you will have a safe return." The giant also gave the widow's son 3 pomegranates as a present, 1 white, 1 green, and 1 red. The lad put them in his pockets, and after sending a sufficiency of water for the caravan, gave a sign to be drawn up. He threw the 3 apples, just as he was instructed by the giant, and reached the surface safely. Just as they had promised, the merchants gave him the 800 pieces of gold, and his master a camel's load of merchandise. The widow's son said to his master that he wanted to send the camel's load of merchandise and the money to his wife. His master consented, and the lad, putting the 3 pomegranates in the load, sent it with the driver to his poor broken-down hut near the bridge under the sycamore tree. The merchant promoted the lad and made him superintendent of the camel drivers. After some time, the merchant died, and his wife continued to do business. She liked the young lad and adopted him as her son. Thus, he worked with the merchant and his wife for 20 years. One day, he was granted permission by his adopted mother to go and visit his family, and he set out on the long journey back to his home. Let's leave them, young lad there, well, not so young now, I guess, and return to his family. A few months after the departure of the young lad, in the way of many new marriages, his humble home was blessed with the birth of his son. When the camel's load of merchandise, money and pomegranates arrived, both the widow and her daughter-in-law were greatly pleased. At the first sight, the princess knew that pomegranates were not common fruits, but jewels. Princesses know these sort of things. But the old widow, who thought they were common pomegranates, prepared to cut them, saying, "Heaven's blessing rest upon you, my son, that you have remembered your aged mother by sending her fruits to eat." The young bride snatched them from her hand and put them in the drawer. Thereupon the old woman was very offended, cursed her daughter-in-law, and withdrew to the adjoining room. The bride ran at once to a neighbouring shop, and buying 3 common pomegranates, brought them to her, saying, "Mama, don't be offended. I'm sorry I was so harsh. Here's the pomegranates. You may have them." And so mother and daughter-in-law were reconciled. The princess then bought new dresses for her mother-in-law, herself, and the baby. She filled her mother-in-law's pocket with gold pieces and, cutting a slice from one of the jeweled pomegranates, put it in a costly golden box and gave it to her, saying, "Now, Mama, go to the king's palace and give him the gold pieces as a present to the attendants. Say you want to see the king. Then give him this golden box with a slice of pomegranate in it. When he asks you what you want, say you've brought it to him as a present, and that you want nothing but a decree, sealed with a royal seal, permitting you to do whatever you please without being molested." The old woman, making herself as smart as she could, started on the errand and did all that the princess had asked her. The king, upon seeing the jewels in the shape of a pomegranate slice, at once called the royal jewellers to set a price on them. The jewellers, examining the slice of pomegranate, said, "No one can set a price on this. Let a lad of 15 stand and throw a stone with all of his might upwards into the sky. A heap of gold as high as that would hardly equal the value of this wonderful row of precious stones." The king, doing a quick mental review of his treasury, didn't think he'd actually got that much gold.
"Do you want the price of this jewel? Or have you bought it as a present to the king?" asked the king of the woman.
"Bought it as a present to your majesty," answered the widow.
"What favour do you want in exchange?" asked the king quite cautiously.
The old woman answered as she had been advised by her daughter-in-law. The king thought that was actually quite a good deal, so the royal decree was immediately signed, sealed, and given to her, and she took it to her daughter-in-law. As soon as the princess had the royal edict, she sent slices of the 3 pomegranates to all the 7 kings of the world and received in recompense treasure unmeasurable. She then built a splendid palace in the place of the poor old hut and decorated it with silver, gold and the rest of the jewels, which illuminated the palace by night, making it as bright and lustrous as the twinkling morning star. The fame of the palace spread all over the world, and people came to see its splendour. The king also came to see it and admired it, because it contained so many beautiful things which were not to be found in his own palace. He visited all parts of it and sighed deeply from his heart, saying, "I wish my only daughter was not lost, and that she lived in this magnificent building." Because by now, he'd married off his other 2 daughters, and he was beginning to really regret what he'd done to his youngest. From behind the curtain, his daughter heard him speak, and she also sighed. The princess's son had by this time grown into a good-looking, intelligent lad, and it was he who made a grand princely reception to the king in the new palace. The king really liked the lad and took him into his service. Seeing that he was an uncommon young man, displaying extraordinary ability in everything he handled, the king was so pleased with him that he had gave him the position of commander of all of his forces, without even knowing it was his own grandson. "Okay, this seems like a good spot to leave the widow, the princess, and her son, and return back to the fate of her husband." He had arrived back to his own country and went directly in pursuit of his wife, with the expectation of finding her in a lowly hut under the sycamore tree. But to his disappointment and surprise, he found in its place a magnificent palace, the most magnificent indeed in his travels, of over 20 years' duration. There was nothing left of the old hut, only the sycamore tree, which had grown taller and thicker during the past 20 years. As a stranger, he walked into the yard, approached the old sycamore tree, the only acquaintance he still had in the neighbourhood, and climbed it. Soon he saw the woman and a commander of the king's forces come to the porch and sit upon the sofa near one another. He recognised the woman as his wife, the princess. 20 years seemed to have made very little change in her beauty. But why was she in this splendid palace and not in his hut? And what was the business of the commander there? His mind began filled with a terrible suspicion, and he drew his bow and arrow with the intention of killing both of them. But just at that moment, he remembered the old monk's second piece of advice. Patience leads to safety. And he released his arms. Presently, he saw the commander and his wife embracing one another. It nearly overcame any advice he'd had from the monk, but he suddenly realised the third piece. This is a good in all instances of patient waiting. And he managed not to shoot. He then, as a sensible person would have done at the beginning, started listening to their talk and heard the commander saying, "Mother, is my father living? Where is he? Last night I dreamed in my dream that he had come home." His mother, deciding he was definitely old enough now, proceeded to tell him the story of his birth, which kept a secret from him until now. "What?
explained the young commander. You, the daughter of the king? I'm the commander of his army. The palace our home, and my father's a wanderer in foreign lands. It's impossible. I will go tomorrow, take my army, and go and find my father. His father, who was listening to his words from the tree, felt great tears rolling down his cheeks. After nightfall, he came down from the tree and spent the night in a neighbouring inn. The following morning, he sent messages to his wife and son, bearing the good tidings of his arrival. Their meeting was a very happy one. The king, hearing the return of his dear commander's father, hastened to express his congratulations and best wishes. Entering the palace, he met, to his great surprise, his daughter, who, with her husband and son, fell on their knees, begging the blessing of the king. The old king was almost mad with joy and embraced them all, shedding tears. "Now I see," he explained, "that it's useless to strive to undo what destiny has decreed." As the king's other daughters were married to princes who had other kingdoms to run. Upon his death, his son-in-law succeeded him upon the throne. Thus they reached the highest position in the world. This tale was a dream. The sender of dreams has sent three apples from above, one for him who told the story, one for him who asked that the story be told, and one for him who listened to the story. And that is the end of my tale. And I hope it pleased you, gentle listener, for it had no other purpose. If you're just here for the story, now is probably a good time to leave us. But if you'd like to know a little bit more, I hope you'll stay with me a little longer. I found this story fascinating. I hadn't read a lot of Armenian folklore previously, but this completely leapt out at me. I'm not sure if it was some of the more unusual elements, or just because I was entranced by the idea of those beautiful jewelled pomegranates. It could have been either, I suppose. I enjoyed how the princess managed to improve the family finances in such a practical but smart fashion. The elements of fantasy and symbolism certainly intrigued me and left me wanting to investigate more about the story and to find out if this was common to Armenian folk tales or whether this was a one-off. So, firstly, an introduction to Armenian folklore would not be complete without a brief history of Armenia. Armenian history is filled with violence, domination by empires, and a fast-flung diaspora as a result of both, shaping the modern national and international identity of its people. Armenians have lived in the area near modern-day Turkey, between the Mediterranean and Caspian Seas, for thousands of years. They're ideally placed, in fact, along the trade route between Europe and the East, that became known as the Silk Road, due to both the wealth that travelled along its route and one of the dominant products being hauled along it, and they were very prosperous and rich in their ancient history. The Armenian people were united into a single nation just once prior to the modern age, in the very end of the 1st century BCE, under the rule of King Tigran the Great. The unification did not last long, and eventually the Armenian people fell under the shadows of first the Byzantine Empire and later the Ottoman Empires. The Armenians did not fare so well under the Ottoman Empire. They enjoyed certain protections, but they were also frequently harassed and the victims of prejudice and official oppression. In the early 20th century, many Western nations began to officially object to the treatment of the Armenian people. The Ottoman Empire, by then very weak and disorganised, decided that this meant the Western powers might intervene militarily, and their solution was forcibly evict the entire Armenian population. Millions were driven out of the country, and many were killed in what is now known as the Armenian Genocide. This is why the Armenian diaspora is so large. So many Armenians fled their homeland for their lives during this period. Today, Armenia is one of several post-Soviet republics, establishing itself as an independent nation for the first time in thousands of years, with the enthusiastic support and affection of its far-flung refugees. Its history of domination and violent oppression has had the ironic effect of making the expatriate Armenians fiercely proud of their heritage, guaranteeing that the Armenian way of life continues, no matter where they have settled. Armenia has a great tradition of oral storytelling, but sadly, due to some of the events and circumstances previously mentioned, there have been substantially fewer attempts to collect these stories in print than in other countries across Europe. I've read The Golden Maiden and other folk tales and fairy stories told in Armenia, collected by A. Seklemenyan, where this story originates, as well as Armenia folk tales and fables by Charles Downing
and 100 Armenian Tales and Their Folkloristic Relevance by Susie Hugassian-Villa, amongst several other books of legends, festivals and folk songs. Listed in further reading on the blog, linked to from my show notes. Armenian folk tales are definitely influenced by their environment. As Seklemanian says, one of the greatest factors in the formation of the distinctively Armenian tales was, no doubt, Mount Ararat, that majestic mountain situated in the middle of an extensive plateau in the heart of Armenia and seen from points distant 3 or 4 days' journey would naturally draw the attention of the people. The many mythological and historical facts attached to it, its hoary, inaccessible peak covered with everlasting snow, its towering heights piercing the sky, its high, steep precipices, its deep canyons, its underground caverns, its fierce storms, and the wild beasts and large birds living on its slopes would naturally give birth to half-true and half-imaginary stories, which gradually, and by lapse of time, would grow into legendary tales. The stories are definitely influenced by Armenia's location on the Silk Road, with stories demonstrating elements that appear commonly in Turkish, Indian and Persian folk tales, as well as their own rich Armenian tradition. 100 Armenian Tales is incredibly interesting, as the author and editor is from the Armenian diaspora herself and collected the tales from her Armenian community in Detroit. She analyses the roots of these tales, their similarities to tales from other cultures, and stories collected in Armenia itself. She also suggests where these would be classified on folk tale indexes, as well as examining how these stories have been affected by their emigration from the country. Now, to our tale. It's called The Poor Widow's Son in the Seklemanian collection, or Wisely Spent in Hugassian-Villa's collection. There are versions of this story in the Azerbaijani, Greek, Italian, Persian, Russian, Caucasian, Georgian and Turkish traditions. This story can be classified as both a princess who was responsible for her own future, my absolute favourite term, and observance of the master's precepts tale. The second type of tale is fairly common across the world, and there are examples from Celtic, British, Mexican and Russian traditions. The first is rarer though, and does not seem to appear in Western tales. I'd suggest that it's rarer because the patriarchal world is not overly keen on a woman disrespecting her father and then still having a good life and a happy ending. I found The Fifth Captain's Tale in 1001 Nights and Kupti and Imani, a Punjabi tale collected by Leonora Lang in the Olive Fairy book. In Kupti and Imani, sewing and weaving are also the princess's route to improving her fortunes before magic takes over. There is probably a lot to be said about how using traditional female skills ensured the princesses retained their femininity in the ear of the audience, even if they were adopting more traditionally masculine attitudes. The most significant folklore element in the story is the pomegranate. In Armenian culture, the pomegranate represents fertility, abundance, and marriage. The fruit played an integral role in a wedding custom widely practiced in ancient Armenia. A bride was given a pomegranate fruit, which she threw against a wall, breaking it into pieces. The resulting scattered seeds ensured the bride future children. Armenia has a detailed history of interaction with the pomegranate, with actual fossilised remains evident from as far back as 1000 BCE. The pomegranate is also significant in the folklore of several other traditions, including Azerbaijan, ancient Egypt, ancient and modern Greece, China, India, Iran, ancient Persia, and ancient Israel. It is present in European Christian motifs, appearing in a 4th century mosaic of Christ, as well as paintings by Da Vinci and Botticelli. The pomegranate also plays an important part in Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year celebration, the seeds representing the potential merits of the year ahead. Have I whet your appetite for the pomegranate yet? As well as having folkloric significance, it's also delicious and has a long and glorious food history. Pomegranates have been cultivated throughout the Middle East, South Asia and Mediterranean region for several millennia. A large dry pomegranate was found in the tomb of Tehuti, the butler of Queen Hatshepsut in Egypt, and Mesopotamian records mention pomegranates from the 3rd millennium BCE onwards. The 4th century BCE Ulboran shipwreck off the coast of Turkey contained remains of pomegranates. As the other things found on the ship included ivory, gold jewellery and perfume, it does suggest that pomegranates may have been considered a luxury item at that time. Pomegranate juice, molasses and vinegar were widely used in many Iranian foods before tomatoes arrived in the Middle East. They are still found in traditional recipes such as fezzentin, a thick sauce made from ground walnuts and pomegranate juice, often served with duck and rice, and in ash et anar, a pomegranate soup. Pomegranate molasses and juice are used in Turkish and Syrian cooking, both to marinate meat for kebabs and garnish sweet and savoury dishes. The seeds are used dried as a spice in Indian and Pakistani cooking. It appears regularly in Greek cooking, especially to accompany aubergine and glazed lamb kebabs. But you can also get pomegranate jam and liqueurs. Pomegranates are a very popular ingredient in the UK now, especially with the influence of Ottolenghi and his popular cookbooks. Pomegranate molasses has received an unexpected surge and can now be purchased in most large supermarkets, whereas 10 years ago you'd have to order online or visit specialist food shops. The health benefits of pomegranate juice are practically miraculous, if you believe everything you read online. This is a recent phenomenon, but the use of pomegranates in English cooking is definitely not new. There are recipes for a range of dishes which appear in medieval cookbooks dating from 1381. There are three recipes that appear in the form of curry, from 1390, one for sauce zarazine, Saracen sauce for serving with capons, berendiles, a sort of spiced chicken pate, and cumin, possibly a sort of eggless, dairy-free sweet custard. Probably not much like bird's custard, although who knows? Sadly, pomegranates did become less common in texts after this, and had sadly disappeared by the 17th century, except for a couple of references. One was as a treatment for a dietary complaint, which I don't think we need to go into, in the English Housewife in 1631, and as a garnish for capons and beef in The Accomplished Cook in 1661, alongside other fruits including pineapple. There doesn't seem to have been a good reason for the disappearance of pomegranate, but I suspect the inability to get the plant to fruit here may have played a part. It was introduced as an exotic plant in the 17th century, but though it could be persuaded to grow in the cooler, damper weather of the British Isles, it was not prepared to fruit, understandably. Pomegranates never had the cachet of pineapple, and so no one spent time working out if they could be raised in the 18th century hothouses. So, that's enough history. Let's move on to our recipe for this week. I considered a sweet dessert, but I thought it would be a missed opportunity to raise a cheer for the cause of using fruit in savoury recipes, especially meat ones. I grew up with this combination and I love it. It tastes special and exotic and takes me away to distant places, even if only for a few mouthfuls. Then I had to make a choice from two recipes, both of which I love, but I decided against the yoghurt meatballs because pomegranate is more of a garnish there. I'm sure I'll find a reason to shoehorn it in somewhere, but today we're all about the slow-cooked lamb in pomegranate juice. As I mentioned above, this is a classic combination. The juice and the slow cooking result in melting, tender lamb, and the juice is reduced to form a spicy, sweet and sour glaze. This is definitely a celebration dish, both for time and budgetary considerations. The joint is marinated in a spice mix for 24 hours before cooking. And as we know, high welfare, locally sourced, good quality meat is not cheap, and nor should it be. We had it for Christmas one year, and it certainly felt special enough. The glowing colours on the table were a joy in the middle of a dreary winter. It might be fanciful, but I think a medieval person would recognise it in the same way, even if the potatoes were a bit of a mystery. And so, we've reached the end of the episode. I'd like to thank you for listening. I'll also add the cheeky aside that if you have enjoyed today's episode, it would be so good and so helpful if you could leave a review on wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the podcast. So, goodbye for now, and I hope you'll come back and listen to the next episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.